Want to dive into how technology and Black spirituality intersect? Or confront the challenges new tech is creating? Maybe even catch a vision of hope for the future?
Check out Moral Repair, a Black exploration of tech. A podcast about the innovations that make our world and break our societies.
And how we can all heal just a bit. Available on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
Our warming planet means the frozen Arctic region is becoming more accessible. With an eye on Russia, NATO is looking to expand its reach into those icy waters.
The operational environment is very harsh, so the dangers are extreme.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Police officers from Kenya are on patrol in Haiti, but the gangs are still firmly in control. And many Haitians are asking questions about these security forces from abroad.
Ultimately, what are they going to do in concrete terms?
Also, hundreds of years ago, mystic minstrels traveled parts of South Asia, performing their religious songs for people of different faiths. And they still do.
I'm a great admirer of these sort of songs from the core of my heart.
All that and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us today. One thing that came out of this week's NATO summit in Washington is about, quote, projecting power into the high latitudes. It's a reference to the Arctic region, and here's why.
That's the sound of a Russian icebreaker ship reportedly plowing through 90-plus inches of ice off the coast of northern Russia. The Kremlin has 36 icebreakers. The U.S. has just two. That's what a new strategic partnership is about. On Thursday, the U.S., Canada, and Finland announced plans to build up their Arctic icebreaker fleets. Katarzyna Zisk is an expert on the geopolitics of the far north. She's a professor at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies. We spoke earlier today, and she started by explaining why the Arctic is becoming a bigger security issue for NATO.
We know that the region is important in economic terms. There are important fish resources, energy resources, minerals and metals. But it's also about potentially strategically important sea lines of communication that are opening in the Arctic for commercial, but also for military use in the future. Climate change is changing also the strategic landscape in the region. Basically, we are seeing the fifth ocean opening on the top of the world, and the various nations want to take advantage of that.
Let's make sure we also just define icebreakers for folks who might not be familiar. They're pretty intense. They're able to crash through really thick ice, right? What can they do?
These are ships that are extremely powerful. I actually been on one. They have a capacity basically to plow through a very, very thick ice. Russia has the most powerful icebreakers that are nuclear powered. And they can also endure for a very long time in the Arctic region, which is quite important given how huge this region is. And there is very scarce infrastructure. They can be important for civilian activity and operation in the region, but they also will be important, for instance, to support ships. It can be tankers, but also military warships. So they are potentially dual capability ships.
So what kind of capabilities would new icebreakers give the U.S., Canada, and Finland that they don't already have now?
So it is important to remember that even though the Arctic waters are opening, there will still be ice there. There will be floating ice. You know, the multipolar ice is disappearing, but there will be still a lot of ice, especially during certain periods of time, which can clog some of the passages. So having an icebreaker capability and also ice-strengthened ships is very important to be able to operate in the region. And Canada has some capacity. The United States is actually, it looks pretty bad for the United States, to be honest. They have some, they have two, but they're aging very quickly. It's been a discussion that has taken more than 15 years about the fact that the United States has an ambition to be an Arctic power, to be present in the region, to strengthen its position, to take advantage of the opening ocean, but they do not have icebreaker capability. There is a huge need to to build new icebergs so the United States can operate in the region in the future.
Russia has really been focused on the Arctic. It has, as I said, many more icebreakers than the U.S. What has Russia been up to in the Arctic of late?
Quite a lot, actually. The Arctic is important for Russia for several reasons. One is the military importance. So especially the Western Arctic, Kola Peninsula, just across the border with Norway, Russia has very important bases and operation area for most of its strategic submarines that can launch intercontinental ballistic missiles. Hugely important area. For Russia, it's also the economic aspect in the Arctic is important. The Arctic region produces more than 20% of the Russian GDP, and Russia has an ambition to increase that number significantly in the future. And it's also symbolically important to Russia. The Arctic has a place in Russia's history, national identity, and it is therefore also well suited for demonstrating Russia's capabilities, communicating the seriousness of Russia's intention, both to the domestic and to the foreign audiences. Russia has conducted a large-scale military modernization program, which included the Arctic since 2008, including nuclear capabilities, non-nuclear capabilities, also dual-capable warships such as diesel-electric icebreakers and also nuclear-powered icebreakers. So Russia has been very much focused on the Arctic since, in particular, since 2007, 2008.
I wonder, you know, the Arctic is opening up because of climate change and the sea ice is melting. What are the environmental concerns about sending a lot more ship traffic up into the Arctic?
That's a very important question and very important aspect of the development. As mentioned, there is very little infrastructure in the region. There can be very harsh and environmental, the operational environment is very harsh. So the dangers are extreme. I participate in some simulations and wargaming where we looked at scenarios that there could be a cruise ship crashing in the region or oil tanking, even worse, and the results would be disastrous both for human life but also for environment. So obviously, this is an aspect that the various nations think about. This is a reason why the Arctic nations signed agreements on search and rescue in the region. The cooperation is absolutely necessary because there region is huge. It's very difficult to navigate, and there's very little capacity and capability that is available. So this is a very important aspect of the whole development, the safety and security and the danger to life and to environment that both civilian and military activity in the region can and will pose in an increasing degree in the future.
Katarzyna Zisk is a professor at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies, and she spoke with us from London.
Paris is making the final preparations for the Summer Games, and soon around 14,000 athletes will be moving into the Olympic Village there. France won its bid to host the Olympics with a promise to transform the neighborhood of Saint-Saint-Denis, which has struggled with high rates of poverty and crime. But many residents have been frustrated by the changes to their neighborhood ahead of the Olympics, and that is not uncommon for host cities. Reporter Andy Crossan discovered that in her hometown of Vancouver, where overblown promises and shifting politics led to broken dreams.
This was the Team Canada building. I can't remember which floor I was on, but
Christine Nesbitt has fond memories of living in this high-end building on Vancouver's waterfront area called False Creek. As a member of Canada's Olympic speed skating team, she lived here for a few weeks during the 2010 Winter Games. Team Canada occupied the whole multi-story building, including a common area in the penthouse. Nesbitt enjoyed the million-dollar view, and she had a great Games, winning gold in the long-track speed skating 1,000-meter event.
You're so used to analyzing your race afterwards, and I had to kind of almost just, like, try to snap out of that. My coach had to come up to me and kind of just, like, shake me and be like, he literally said, you won the Olympics.
Nesbitt competed in a total of 3 Winter Games, and when it was time to hang up her skates in 2015, she decided to study urban planning. In fact, she wrote her master's thesis on the Olympic villages where she competed, Turin, Vancouver, and Sochi.
Affordable and social housing as a legacy for an Olympic village was not really something, from my research, from what I uncovered, it wasn't really something that cities aimed for until kind of the 90s and moving forward.
In the 90s, Vancouver was facing a growing housing crisis. Skyrocketing home prices, low supply of rental units, and very little housing for low-income residents. So when Vancouver bid for the Games, government-subsidized housing or social housing was part of the package.
I think that's what won a lot of people over, was that commitment to social housing.
The original plan for the post-Games Olympic Village was that two-thirds of the 1,100 units would be affordable housing, and a full half of that would be subsidized housing for those most in need. But as the Games got closer, the promises started to fall apart. Nesbitt says that changes in City Hall played a role in what unfolded.
It's a huge part of the reason why we under-delivered on our social and affordable housing is because you had a change in mayor and council that rewrote the policy and substantially cut back on what the city had promised and what residents had voted yes on.
And in Vancouver, people literally voted on whether to host the Games. The city held a referendum ahead of the bid submission, and the majority of people who voted said yes. But city politics can be tough business. And when you plan an Olympics, you can have one mayor who bids for the Games, another mayor who inherits the Games and has to prepare the city, and yet another mayor who hosts the Games.
It didn't go as well as I thought.
That's former Vancouver Mayor Sam Sullivan. He's the one in the middle, mayor number two, who inherited the Games, but was out of office before Vancouver hosted them in 2010.
The government that actually was around when the Olympics happened, it was a government that didn't want the Olympics. Their whole election campaign was about what a terrible thing the Olympic Village was, you know, because it was cost overruns and just a big disaster.
We'll get back to the cost overruns and the disaster that Sullivan is referring to. But now seems like a good time to meet the person Sullivan says didn't want the Games. That's mayor number three.
I mean, you can make other choices about bringing economic opportunity. You don't have to host the Olympics to do that.
Former Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson.
You know, it's got a rah-rah factor that I think Vancouver benefited from in some ways. Being fantastic hosts for the world and home to many cultures. So, you know, those are all good things. I don't think we necessarily need to do it again.
Okay, now you need to remember what was going on around that time that Vancouver was preparing for the Games in the late 2000s.
Wall Street veterans call it the worst financial crisis of their lifetimes.
The nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve, is backing a loan to prevent the collapse of investment bank Bear Stearns and to stabilize the financial markets.
When the 2008 financial crisis hit, the developer in charge of building Vancouver's Olympic Village no longer had the money to complete the project. The city wound up having to pay $690 million to get it done. And to cover that hefty bill, the city council cut back on the committed number of social housing units and instead allocated more units to be sold off as condos at market rate. There was a huge outcry, but the city had a partially built village and a very real deadline. Here's former Mayor Sam Sullivan again.
Yes, there's no doubt there was decisions in the Olympic Village that I don't think were the best. They could have been done better, but we had to move. We had to get it done.
In the end, only around 250 affordable housing units were ever made available in the former Athletes Village. And now it's a neighborhood filled with craft beer patios and upscale bakeries. For Christine Nesbitt, she's still proud of her Olympic gold, but sees the Vancouver Games as a missed opportunity.
You're getting all this influx of funding and you want this jewel in your crown, so to speak. But if you're not uplifting those who need it most, then it's just perpetuating the same cycle, furthering the divide between those who are wealthy and those who are not.
As we make our way along the seawall in the Olympic Village, I spot a patch of blue nylon peeking out from beneath some blackberry brambles.
Somebody in a tent right next to us.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All the way around False Creek, there's just tents.
Yeah.
These days, the city's poorest residents live in tents wherever they can find space, including the Olympic Village. Not exactly the housing promised in that Olympic bid all those years ago. For The World, I'm Andy Crossan, Vancouver.
This story is part of the podcast State of Play from the Global Reporting Center and PRX. Our team at The World has been gearing up for the Summer Games with extensive reporting, including on the housing pressures in Paris itself. Find all of our stories at theworld.org. People in Tamaulipas state in northern Mexico are seeing a noticeable impact of recent heavy rains. Crocodiles are showing up in towns there, nearly 200 of them since June. Tropical Storm Alberto and Hurricane Beryl overwhelmed local waterways, causing the big reptiles to crawl into cities like Tampico and Altamira.
Crocodiles are a protected species in Mexico. Environment officials have been able to relocate a few dozen of them to better habitats in unpopulated areas. We will have more on the aftermath of Hurricane Beryl just ahead in the show. You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. From the Caribbean islands through Texas and all the way to New England, Hurricane Beryl has left a swath of destruction. The hurricane is blamed for the deaths of at least 20 people in the U.S. and Caribbean. Aaron Gwinnett is the general manager for the Liming Bekwe Hotel on the island of Bekwe. It's part of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. As he looks back on last week's storm, he describes their particular island as relatively unscathed.
Thankfully, our villas were all intact. Our only loss really was our restaurant pavilion area. We suffered some serious hits there. Our pier was kind of like three quarters washed away. Our breakwater was severely damaged. And we've had a couple of rough days, put it that way.
Did you have any guests at your hotel at the time the hurricane came through?
No, we didn't. Thankfully, we thought it was best to get them off the property and get them off the island because we knew that this kind of category hurricane could leave a little bit of devastation. And luckily we did because we were without power and electricity for about a week.
Now, I know governments and aid agencies are promising to spend millions of dollars to help. And I know that rescue workers are on your island right now. Have you been contacted at all by them or any of the agencies involved?
Nope, no one has contacted us. No one has made a reach out to us to ask how we're doing. Do we need any help? Do we need anything? We've actually used our own team, our own locals, to remove the debris, the issues, cut down trees and, you know, reopen roads, get electricity going in the area. So, yeah, we haven't really had any outside help.
Do storms like this hit the island of Bekwe frequently or is something like this at this early in the hurricane season kind of unusual?
Well, put it this way, a lot of the locals here, this is their first time ever seeing a hurricane of this category and strength hit Bekwe. Me, myself, I've been through six hurricanes since I've been in the Caribbean.
Oh.
I was in Belize last year for the hurricane that hit Belize. And then a couple of years ago, I was in St. Lucia for two hurricanes. And I was in for another two in Anguilla.
Now, from what I can see online, your hotel is really in an idyllic setting. But are you worried it won't last with storms like these kind of on the rise?
Yes, I do worry sometimes. I mean, if it wasn't for our breakwater and our pier, we would have lost a lot more in a sense of land and probably villas because the swells that we were getting were like between 15 to 20 feet. They were actually coming and hitting our breakwater. So, I mean, this kind of category storm, if it came up any higher than what it was, it would have literally flattened this island. So, I mean, the eye of the storm was about, 30, 40 kilometers south of us. If it had come up higher, we would have been in serious trouble.
What are your plans for your hotel? I mean, as you kind of rebuild or fix up, do you think about it differently with this kind of thing having happened?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, with the main restaurant pavilion, which is located over the water, we have to restructure our whole breakwater area there because the strength of the waves that came up were intense. They were moving large boulders like they were marbles. So we have to really look at that and develop that up. And so in the next 3 to 4 months, that's what we're going to be doing. I mean, we have closed the property down until the middle of October now. So by time season comes in November this year, we'll be back to 100% occupancy and running properly as well.
Given that it's only July and the hurricane season typically starts in September, are you kind of bracing yourself for what's going to happen then?
Yes. I mean, after having this hurricane so early, I mean, it's literally the first month of hurricane season starts really in the beginning of July. So literally to get a hurricane that early, that powerful is a scary, scary factor.
Aaron Gwinnett is the general manager of the Liming Bekwe Hotel on the island of Bekwe. It's part of St. Vincent and the Grenadines in the Caribbean.
The heyday for silent films is long gone. Here in the U.S., they're mostly the occasional fare of art house cinemas. But in Belgium, they are alive and well. For decades, the film archive there has been showing three or four silent pictures per week to a dedicated audience, all with a live piano accompaniment. Theo Mertz first reported our story in Brussels last summer.
It's a warm Saturday evening in Brussels. In the dark of the Cinematheque, we're watching Isn't Life Wonderful, a 1924 movie by the American director D.W. Griffith. It's the story of a couple of Polish refugees who fall in love despite the hardships they face in Germany following the recent First World War. It's one of Griffith's lesser-known works, but it's attracted a decent audience, ranging in age from teenagers to the retired. Christophe Piette chooses which films will screen here.
We have an amazing collection of silent films. In the Cinémathèque. It is a museum like, you could say, Paris has the Louvre Museum. It's a bit pretentious for me to say that because I'm working here, but it is really the case. It's a really unique collection in the world.
He says around 80% of silent movies have been lost forever. At the time they're being made, the industry just wasn't very interested in preserving its output. But Piette's predecessors tasked themselves with collecting every single silent film that remained. Now the Cinémathèque has about 10,000 such movies.
They really wanted to share it with the audience and with younger people that are used to younger films, to recent films, and to show them where cinema was coming from. It is our mission, we have a historical mission, to show whole of film history.
The silent film program has been going since the 1980s, and Piette says it's as popular as ever. But he complains about a lack of funding from the Belgian government, especially given the Cinémathèque's unique status and the broad audience it attracts. Luca Vienne is 17 years old. He comes to the Cinémathèque most days and is in the audience for Isn't Life Wonderful.
I started coming here to see a very popular movie, like Shining and stuff like that. But then I started to go check films that I never heard of.
Now, Vienne says he doesn't see much difference between silent film and more recent movies. For him, it's all cinema.
I'm also interested in the history of cinema, and so coming back to silent film is sometimes interesting to see how it evolved.
For the price of a ticket, audiences not only get to see a movie, they also get a live concert. Hugues Marichal is one of a roster of pianists who accompany every single film. He's 59 and he's been working here part-time for more than three decades. Marichal's a professional performer and composer, but when he's playing here, his main aim is to blend into the background.
We have a romantic scene. You're not to be the star. The star is the movie. The best compliment you can make to a silent movie pianist is, "Whoa, I forget you were there."
Often, pianists are seeing the film for the first time, and everything they play is entirely improvised.
You just let the picture on the screen, the movie, impress you, and the impression came in your body and in your fingers, and you play.
Marichal says that interest in the screenings dipped when film on demand became widely available at home. Now it's picking up again as audiences seek out something different.
But now, I want a new experience. I want an experience with live music. I want an experience with big screen. And so, yes, for young people, it's very interesting.
Many of the films he accompanies are 100 years old now, if not more. But the Cinémathèque hopes it'll still be attracting an audience 100 years into the future. For The World, I'm Theo Mertz in Brussels.
You're listening to The World. Demand for electric vehicles is fueling a race for more lithium in South America and elsewhere, but the opportunity for cashing in may be limited.
Some experts say that in as little as 10 years, the world is going to be using a lot more recycled lithium, so we're just not going to need to pull as much out of the ground.
More on that ahead on today's edition of The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. They've been deployed for nearly 3 weeks, but several hundred Kenyan police officers on patrol in Haiti have their work cut out for them. Criminal gangs still control 80% of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, and many locals say they have yet to see much of an impact. Widlar Maricor is a journalist in Port-au-Prince. He says Haitians are waiting to see what this mission can accomplish.
So far, the Haitian population is asking, you know, themselves lots of questions with regard to, you know, this force, with regard to its mission, with regard to ultimately what are they going to do in concrete terms against the gangs, because it's been several weeks since they arrived. At first, you had the impression that the gangs, they were stunned and they were in some sort of waiting mode to see what it is that was going to happen. But in the recent weeks, the violence and the destructions continued. You know, kidnappings is rampant. They attack civil institutions. They continue killing people. Although we have the gangs calling for dialogue, the prime minister said there won't be any dialogue before surrender.
So at this point, 3 weeks in, how visible are the Kenyan police in Port-au-Prince? I mean, if you walk around the streets, do you see them?
You don't. The Kenyans conduct small-scale patrol on a random basis with the Haitian National Police. But in terms of attacking and direct contacts with the gangs, they have yet to do so. They were seen, for instance, close to the U.S. embassy. The report says they were not there to protect the embassy itself. But people start criticizing it nonetheless, because as the Kenyans appear not to be taking any actions against the gangs, displacements are, you know, still ongoing. The killings are still ongoing, and the chaos in the country is still the same.
So it sounds like you're saying the Kenyan police, their presence in Port-au-Prince hasn't had much of an impact yet. Did Haitians have expectations that they would see an improvement in their security by now?
Many people accept the idea that they have to kind of understand their territory and understand how the gangs work before attacking the gangs. But as time, you know, is passing by, people expected that by now they would have been ready to attack the gangs and take back some of the key territories. But because we have to remember, Port-au-Prince right now is the Haiti capital, and it's isolated to the rest of the country by road, because the north of the country is controlled by gangs. The roads going to the north is controlled by gangs. And also, it's extremely difficult to go to the south of the country because of gang control. And these are the roads that, you know, people use to bring stuff that they produce in the countryside to the capital. And increasingly, they are using boats, but some of these boats are also attacked by the gangs.
So you're saying gangs are really kind of isolating Port-au-Prince and blocking roads coming in and out, which is also affecting the Haitian economy. I mean, the security mission is eventually supposed to reach about 2,500 police from a number of different countries, Barbados, Belize, Benin, several countries. When is the next group of police supposed to arrive?
Well, if you talk to the office of the prime minister, the new prime minister, Mr. Gary Kuni, they tell you, you know, they are supposed to be there, you know, at any time now. But what is the real timeline? We don't know. The force had a press conference recently, and one of the leaders said, we will attack the gangs and we will, you know, conduct operations. The Haitian National Police says so as well. However, they say for strategic purposes, we cannot disclose when is this going to happen. And we are also hearing some calls for dialogue and discussions and some sort of process where gang leaders could discuss with authorities, surrender in an orderly manner that would avoid a bloodbath.
Haiti has a history of foreign intervention, and most times it hasn't gone very well. How hopeful are Haitians that this one might turn out differently?
We did not see an outpouring, no support, demonstration of support for the force. So that says a lot, in my opinion. But there is also, I mean, talk to people in the streets and see the comments all over the internet. People are saying, we hope that they are going to do something. We hope they help the Haitian National Police to take back the territories controlled by the gangs. But you see people, you know, reminding themselves and reminding the neighbors of what happened last time. Last time from 2004, 2017. A UN peacekeeping mission bring cholera to the country, and that's more than 10,000 people dead, more than 800,000 people infected by the disease, and the country is still struggling with cholera. So you have this fear, but it's known today that, you know, the Haitian population has suffered for years now under gun control. And if this force can help in any way to bring back some sense of normalcy, I think they would be applauded. But so far, people are skeptical.
Widlor Marincor is editor-in-chief of the Ayibo Post. He's based in Port-au-Prince. And now, let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
A Russian plot to kill an executive from one of Europe's most prominent weapons manufacturers earlier this year was foiled, according to unnamed U.S. and German officials. The CEO of Rheinmetall, a German company that makes tanks and armored vehicles, was reportedly the target. But the alleged plot was never attempted after his personal security was ramped up.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is seeking re-election. He's not on the ballot just once, but 13 times, each instance for one of the many different political groups he's representing. Civic organizations and opposition leaders say the ballot will be confusing for voters.
And in Australia, an art exhibit that stoked a gender war is revealed to be a fraud. Earlier this year, we told you about Tasmania's Mona Museum and its exhibit of Picasso paintings that was open only to women visitors. Now, the curator of that exhibit says she, and not Picasso, actually painted the artwork. Kersha Kayshell says the art had been on display for more than 3 years before its authenticity was questioned.
And that's a few things you might have missed. We are staring down a big weekend in sports. First, soccer, with the finals of two major global tournaments coming up. Copa America will crown the best team in the Americas, with the finals being held in Florida, where Colombia and Argentina face off on Sunday. Also on Sunday, on the other side of the Atlantic, Spain and England meet in the finals of the European Championship. We'll relive the agony and the ecstasy of both soccer tournaments with you on Monday's show. But if soccer is not your thing, maybe tennis is. The top global tennis stars are in London, ready for the famed center court at Wimbledon. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the remaining athletes heading into the finals this weekend.
2024 has been a good year for Jasmine Paolini.
Absolute joy for Jasmine Paolini. It's the win of her life.
Just last month, the 28-year-old Italian unexpectedly made it to the finals of the French Open, losing only to world number one, Iga Świątek. And yesterday in London...
I'm so happy with this win. I think this match I will remember forever, I think.
Paolini secured her spot in the finals of Wimbledon. She's the first woman to make the finals of the French Open and Wimbledon in the same season since Serena Williams in 2016.
I think these last months have been crazy for me.
The nearly three-hour semi-final left both players understandably exhausted. Christy Bogert, a professional tennis player turned commentator from the Netherlands, says Paolini's ability to perform so well on different surfaces sets her apart from the rest of the field.
A couple weeks ago with her coach on the court, they were practicing on reducing the backswing on the forehand, for example, because you have less time on the grass. So she's been able to adapt her game style to the surface.
Bogert adds that world number one, Iga Świątek, could learn from this. She's known as the queen of the clay and was upset in just the third round on Wimbledon's grass this year. Tomorrow, Jasmine Paolini will face Barbora Krejčíková from the Czech Republic, who's ranked 25th in the world. After coming back from behind to win her semifinal, Krejčíková paid tribute to the late Jana Novotná, a fellow Czech tennis pro who won Wimbledon in 1998.
I'm thinking about Jana a lot, and when I step on the court here, I'm just fighting for every single ball because that's what I think she would want me to do.
Krejčíková wiped away tears, and the crowd cheered in support.
Are you okay? I just miss her very much. I miss her so much.
Whether Krejčíková or Paolini win tomorrow, a new woman will earn the title for the first time. The reigning champ is in the finals on the men's side, though. Carlos Alcaraz.
And on he goes. The dream of the title defense is still alive.
Alcaraz beat Daniil Medvedev today and says going into Sunday's final, he feels prepared now that he's no longer the new kid on the block. He also bravely mentioned Sunday's Euro soccer final between his home country, Spain, and England.
It's going to be a really good day for Spanish people as well, you know, with the Euro Cup.
The largely English crowd jokingly booed him. The Spaniard will be serious on Sunday, though, when he takes on another player you may recognize, Novak Djokovic of Serbia. Wimbledon is just the first stop of a whirlwind summer for tennis. Here's former pro Christy Bogert again.
I just love the Olympics. It's a special tournament, special occasion. I consider it like a fifth Grand Slam.
Olympic tennis matches start just 13 days after Wimbledon. Athletes will play on clay at Roland Garros, where the French Open is held. And just 10 days after the Olympics, the U.S. Open starts on hard courts.
It's a hectic travel schedule, of course. And you really have to take care of your body. That's one thing, because changing surfaces is really, it's hard on the body in such a short time.
This back-to-back-to-back schedule only happens once every 4 years, though. And with the right team and support staff, Bogert says the pros should be able to handle it. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
A transition to renewable energy will require lots of changes. One of them is an increase in lithium mining. Think about all those EV batteries. The country of Chile has a lot of lithium, the largest reserves on Earth, in fact. It's currently the world's second largest producer of the metal, and the government is hoping to boost that production. It's now considering more than 80 proposals for additional lithium projects. Patricia Guerra reports on natural resources in Santiago, Chile.
Right now, the government is hoping to double production in about 10 years. But as we well know in Latin America, sometimes having a lot of resource underground is a lot less important than the conditions above ground. So it's no guarantee of success that Chile has a lot of resource.
One of the issues that you point out in your reporting is that state-run companies have, you know, a distinct advantage in the mining and production of lithium in Chile. Why is that?
The Boric administration came in on a very progressive platform, promising a much larger role for the state. Having said that, I think a lot of that idea of the state being in the driver's seat has really clashed with the reality of the state not necessarily having the resources or the technological capacity to really take over what is a very technical and capital-intensive industry.
Lithium production is all up in northern Chile in the salt flats of the Atacama Desert. There are a number of indigenous communities there. What are their attitudes toward this push for more lithium mining?
Some of them are sort of on board with development. They feel invested. They've been, you know, working with the two existing producers for a very long time. That's SQM, a Chilean company, and Albemarle, an American company. And others are not. Others worry, for instance, about water. They also worry about areas that they consider sacred. You know, they worry about their land being taken away, or they just want to be, you know, parties to some of these developments. The government has said whatever it does in terms of the new lithium areas, it promises to carry out consultations with the indigenous communities. Of course, it's never clear if those consultations will be binding or not binding. It's really important, I think, to point out lithium in Chile is considered a strategic resource that can just be concessioned to the private sector like it is in many parts of the world.
Mining always comes with environmental considerations. The president, Gabriel Boric, has said he wants to increase lithium production without compromising the environment. Briefly, what's at risk environmentally here?
Water is the big one. The Boric administration has said that it will prioritize companies that promise to use a special technology that would imply less use of water and more efficient extraction of the resource.
The problem is that from the investor perspective, their view is, look, we are going to look at the technology that's going to work best, that's going to meet Chile's environmental standards, that is going to be good for the social commitments that we've made, the environmental commitments that we've made. But there is a concern that the government is being sort of too prescriptive about the technology. There are also questions about all the construction around a mine, all the use of energy that's required to develop a mine, to keep a mine operating, the trucks that would go in and out. There are giant copper mines in that part of the country. So many people are used to that. Mm. Nonetheless, lithium would add a whole nother layer of development that I think particularly for some of the base of Boric's coalition runs against sort of this idea that Chile needs to reorient its economic development along greener lines, along more sustainable lines.
Chile is part of what's called the Lithium Triangle, along with its neighbors, Argentina and Bolivia. How does Chile's approach differ from theirs?
Chile's leg in that triangle is really not looking as sturdy as it once did. You know, if you look, for example, at Argentina, particularly under the new president, you have a situation in which the private sector is really being encouraged to come in, and they're moving much more quickly than Chile is. And Chile's enormously, I think, burdened by a permitting system, which is very onerous. And so the government is trying to address this. But I think that the contrast between Chile and Argentina at this point in time is quite stark. Mm. Having said that, you know, Chile has a long legacy of stability, and it also has what its neighbors don't. It has a free trade agreement with the United States. It has trade agreements with Europe as well. And this gives Chile a really special advantage in terms of critical minerals like lithium. There's really a window for lithium because some experts say that in as little as 10 years, the world is going to be using a lot more recycled lithium. So we're just not going to need to pull as much of lithium out of the ground. And Chile is not necessarily maybe moving fast enough to take advantage of that.
Patricia Garup is a reporter based in Chile who focuses on natural resources. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Over the top would be an understatement for a wedding underway right now. We're talking about the nuptials of Anant Ambani and Radhika Merchant this weekend in Mumbai.
Ambani is the son of Asia's richest man, and the billionaire wedding vibe has been prominently on display for months. This weekend is the main event, 4 days of partying with global politicians, pop stars, and tycoons.
The venue is Mumbai's World Convention Center, which the Ambani family owns. The guests include elites from Boris Johnson to Kim Kardashian, with celebrity arrivals at the wedding being broadcast on TV. Not surprisingly, the extravagance is frustrating for some Indians.
Police are diverting traffic in Mumbai to accommodate the wedding, causing traffic jams and disruptions for locals. And then there's the conspicuous display of extreme wealth in a country where the gap between rich and poor is large and growing. The groom's father, Mukesh Ambani, has a reported net worth of $116 billion. For hundreds of years, mystic troubadours in India and Bangladesh have been singing songs inspired by Hinduism, Islam, and Buddhism. The singers are called the Bauls. Reporter Philip Salata brings us the story of one singer who has been traveling the world to share the songs of the Bauls.
Parvathi Bawal's voice unravels over the countryside in the Indian state of West Bengal. The song is a poem about being in the present. The present takes on the form of an upside-down tree with its roots in the future and its branches in the past.
Because from the root only, you know, it nourishes, and what is left behind is the flower and the fruits.
Parvathi Bawal's surname comes from the music she practices. Bawal is a mystic musical tradition native to rural Bangladesh in eastern India. Her students refer to her as Parvathi Ma. Ma means mother and is a sign of respect. and the orange cloth she wears symbolizes the ascetic life she lives in an ashram. Baul songs and poems contain influences from Hinduism, Islam, and Buddhism, and yet no one religion dominates Baul beliefs and music. What stands out is the connection between song and presence.
So present is actually continuous. So how can we not live with the mind in the back and follow this present? Through our music and dance, we are trying to be in that space also, like an empty vessel.
The dance consists of delicate undulating movements and mesmerizing turns, all while singing and playing an instrument.
So there is no presence of past or future while you are singing and performing, and you just become a receiver.
Parvati sees Baul as West Bengal's spiritual caretakers. Some are now looking to their songs and history as an example of embracing religious diversity in a time of political turmoil. Today, as India's ruling party stokes tensions between Hindus and Muslims, the Baul's represent the opposite. They draw on both religions and reach for something beyond the tensions, says Parvati.
And they were the one who held the harmony and the spiritual health of this large Bengal. But they worked so silently, they never even tried to preach anything.
Baul's historically traveled from village to village, singing in exchange for offerings. This wandering way was also woven into Baul poetry as an understanding that nothing is permanent. They refer to it as rootlessness. But Parvati Ma now has a home base, an ashram, a form of monastery or practicing community that she founded. This is not unusual nowadays. Sukanya Chakrabarty, a Baul scholar in San Jose State University, says it's also not a move away from tradition.
The practicing Bauls today, even if they have an ashram, I don't think they consider themselves rooted or rootless. I don't think their sense of identity comes from physical space as much as this kind of inner sense of being.
The train ride from Kolkata to Parvati's ashram wakes up all the senses. Vendors leap onto the train as it rolls away from the platform and cut their way up and down the aisles. The doors stay wide open as the draft swirls in from the countryside, but one voice weaves all that together. Sujindas, a Baul singer, makes his living performing on commuter trains. Like many passengers, Sumitra Banerjee is transfixed by the melody and visibly moved. He says the song reminds him of his childhood.
I'm a great admirer of these sort of songs from the core of my heart.
Banerjee adds that for many Bengalis, the songs are part of the fabric of everyday life. Parvati built her ashram just outside Shantiniketan, the famed town where India's national hero and Nobel laureate Rabindranath Tagore came to live. Tagore was deeply influenced by Baul poetry, and his work helped destigmatize the tradition. Under British colonial rule, many traditional rituals and practices were deemed taboo, as was itinerancy, says Sukanya Chakrabarty.
The way they have been captured in historical records is that, like, kappa, you know, mad, essentially, and like mendicants, right? Like beggars. We all know that, you know, with colonial historiographers, and we have recorded versions of several art forms and cultural forms that have been distorted, essentially.
This belief still exists in society and makes it harder for Baul traditions to survive in the contemporary world, according to Ram Chandra, a longtime student of Parvati's.
One of the first things that modern education does, in my view, to an individual is to instill low self-esteem and low self-confidence about your own knowledge systems.
Tagore's influence wasn't enough to completely remove prejudices against the Baals. They have continued to be looked down on for flaunting caste rules and accused of breaking religious taboos, being called not Hindu enough or Muslim enough. And it isn't until recently that folk art has drawn respect in a rapidly modernizing India. Parvati Baul is an example of that story.
The Baula Travelers, Travelers of Time.
For The World, I'm Philip Salata, West Bengal, India.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your weekend.